still, Trayvan objected, you are uncle to the little ones, at considerable personal damage. He shrugged. To quote your own words, he replied wryly, that's what friends do. I think they're well worth indulging. So, you've obviously enlarged the nest, and it's wonderful. The new chamber doesn't look tacked on. It looks like it was built with the original. What else are you planning to do?
We thought, perhaps, a chamber for the younglings to play in foul weather.
They discussed further improvements for a moment, until a shadow passed over Darkwyn, and he looked up at the sound of his name whistled in Griffin. Then, once again, he had to protect his eyes, as Hydona, Trayvan's mate, landed in the clearing before the nest, driving up a stronger wind with her wings than Trayvan had. Darkwyn rose to his feet to greet her. She was larger than Trayvan, and her dusty brown coloration was a muted copy of his golden brown feathers. There was more gray in her markings, and less black. Her eyes were the same warm, lovely gold as Trayvan's, though, and she was just as pleased to see him as her mate had been. She nuzzled him and gripped her shoulder gently, purring loud enough to vibrate his very bones. He buried his hands in her neck feathers and scratched the place at the back of her neck she could never reach herself. The most intimate caress possible to a griffin, short of mating behavior. She and Trayvan had been extraordinarily open with him, especially after the death of his mother, allowing him glimpses of their personal life that most humans were never allowed to see. They were, all in all, quite private creatures. Of all the Taladras, only Darkwind was considered an intimate friend. They had not even allowed Dawnfire, who was possibly the best of all the Kashena at dealing with non-humans, to come that close to them.
So, Hydona sighed, after a long and luxurious scratch, this is your patrol time. It must be business that brings you, and business is serious. How can we help?
Darkwind looked into her brilliant deep eyes.
I want to ask advice, and maybe some favors, he said. I seem to have acquired a problem.
Hydona's ear tops perked up.
Acquired a problem? Interesting word choice. Say on.
He chose a comfortable rock as she curled up beside her mate. Well, he began, it happened this way. Chapter 9, Elspeth. Master Quentin reread the message from his old employer, Captain Carowin. Harold Captain Carowin. He was going to have to remember that. Not that the new title seemed to have changed her much. Quentin, I have a job for you, and a sizable retainer enclosed to make you go along with it. Important personage coming your way. Keep said personage from notice if possible. Official and sensitive business. Will have one escort along, but is capable of taking care of self in a fight. Personage needs either a mage for hire, a damn good one, or training, or both. Use your own judgment. Pass personage on to uncle if you have to. Thank you for your help. Write if you find a real job.
Carowin.
He smiled at the joke. No, Carowin hadn't changed, ever since becoming one of the white-clad targets for the Queen of Valdemar. Although Quentin also had no doubts that she refused to wear the white uniform without a royal decree. Quentin thanked the courier for the message and offered him the hospitality of the post for his recovery stay. It was graciously accepted, and the young man, one of King Farum's squires, offered to share gossip of the Rethwellen court with him, in return come dinner.
And people wonder how we get our information.
The squire was an affable youngster, fresh from the hill district, with a backcountry burr still strong in his speech. He made Quentin quite nostalgic for the old days with the Skybolts. A good half of them came out of the hill district facing Karth, with their tough little ponies and all their worldly goods in a saddle pack up behind them. What they lacked in possessions, they tended to make up for in marksmanship, tracking, and a tough-minded approach to life, something Caro had called attitude. He had all of that, with a veneer of gentility that told Quentin he was from one of the noble families that hung on there,
after fighting their way to the local high seat and holding it by craft, guile, and sheer stubborn resilience. His eyes went round at Quentin's pair of mage lights over the table, though he never said a word about them. He knew how to use the eating utensils, though, which was more than Carol's hill lasses and lads generally did. He'd gotten that much out of civilization. But because he was so new to court, he couldn't tell Quentin what the mage really wanted to know, just who and what this personage was. "There's two of them, about a day behind me, I'd reckon," the young man said around a mouthful of Quentin's favorite egg and cheese pie. "One man, one girl, done up all in white, with white horses. Fast they are, the horses, I mean. I say about a day, 'cause I started out a week ahead, but I reckon they've made it up by now. That's how fast them horses are." Well, done up all in white, in connection with the note from Carol, meant they were heralds out of Aldemar. But what heralds could possibly want with a mage was beyond him. He recalled quite vividly his encounter with Valdemar's border protections. He didn't think they'd be able to pay any mage enough to put up with that. Still, that wasn't for him to say. Maybe there was a way around it. He'd have to wait and see. But who were these heralds? They'd have to be important for Carol to exert herself on their behalf, and equally important for King Farum to have sent one of his own squires on ahead with Carol's message to warn him that they were coming. He put that question to the youngster over dessert, when the squire had sipped just enough of Quentin's potent sweet wine to be a little indiscreet. Eris wine does it every time. The young man rolled his wide blue eyes. "Well, as to that," he replied, "no one said for sure, but the young lady, I think she must be related. I overheard her call his majesty uncle when the king gave me the packet and instructions just before I left. I reckon she's Darren's get, though I'd never heard of her before." "Darren's child?" Quentin snorted to himself with amusement. "And a herald of Valdemar? Not unless the twins are aging a year for every month since they've been born. But Selene's oldest child. Now that's a possibility, though I wouldn't have thought they'd let her out of the city, much less the kingdom. Interesting. Something must be going on in that war with Hardorn that I don't know about. I thought it was back to staring at each other across the border." He sat back in his chair while the young man rattled on and sipped his own wine. Suddenly, the stakes were not just Carol asking a favor, not with a princess riding through Rethwellen incognito, looking for mages to hire. This had all the flavor of an intrigue, with the backing of the Valdemarin crown, and it promised both danger and the possibility of rapid and high advancement. Quentin had a good many pupils that would find those prospects attractive enough to chance the protections keeping mages out. Maybe they even found a way to cancel them. That might be why they're finally coming down here now. In fact, now that Quentin was master class and could be a low-level adept if he ever bothered to take the test, it was possible that it was attractive enough to interest him. It might be worth trying to find a way around those watchers, whatever they were, if they hadn't been countered already. Court mage of Valdemar. For a moment, visions of fame and fortune danced in his head. Then he recalled why he wasn't a court mage now. The competition, the rivalry, and above all, the restrictions on what he could and could not do or say. He'd been offered the position, and more than once. So had Jendar, as far as that went. Both of them had preferred to help friends to the post, friends who would tell them what was going on, and keep up casual ties with the rulers of the time. Sometimes a king preferred to go outside his court for advice. To a mage, say, with no other obvious axes to grind. He laughed at himself then, and bent his attention to the amusing stories the young squire brought from court, and remembered what he had once told Carol. "If I had to choose between freedom to do what's right and a comfortable high court position, I'll take the freedom." She had shrugged, but her smile told him that she tacitly agreed with him, which was probably why she was making a target of herself in Valdemar right now. "We're both fools," he thought, and chuckled. The squire, who thought the mage was chuckling at one of his jokes,
glowed appreciatively. Quentin used the same office and suite of rooms that the captain had, back when Bolthaven was the Skybolt's winter quarters, and not a mage school. Placed high up in a multi-story tower that overlooked most of the town as well as the former fortress, he had a clear view of the main gate and the road leading to it, the exercise yard, and most of the buildings. Carol might not recognize the place at first sight anymore. The exercise yard had been planted and sodded and turned into a garden. He'd had trees and bushes brought in and scattered about to provide shade, and most of the buildings had been refaced with brick. The barracks were a dormitory now, and looked it, with clothing drying on the sills, food or drink placed there to cool, kites flying from the rooftop, and youngsters sitting or hanging out of most of the windows. The main stable was a workshop, where anything that was likely to blow the place up could be practiced in relative safety. Only the smaller visitor stable remained to house the few horses Bolthaven needed. While he kept the stockade as a means of defining boundaries beyond which the students were not permitted without permission, the place didn't look like a fortress anymore. It looked like what it was, a school. And not just any school, the largest White Wind school in Rethwellen. The only one that was larger was the school Kethri had attended in Jacasa. Her son, Jendar, Quentin's teacher, had founded a school near Petras, the capital of Rethwellen, in a little town called Great Harzy, but it had never been this large. Then again, mage schools can be dangerous for the innocent townsfolk. Sometimes things get a little out of hand. Townsfolk can get downright touchy over the occasional earth elemental in the scullery. Can't imagine why. That hadn't been a problem for Quentin. The town of Bolthaven had been built around the garrison. The folk here depended on it for their custom. They'd been relieved to learn that there would still be custom here, and most of them had been able to turn their trades to suit young mages instead of young mercs. And, all told, an earth elemental in the scullery did less damage, and was less of a hazard to the problematical virtue of the health, than any drunken merc bent on celebration. The worst that ever came up from Bolthaven now was an urgent call for one of the teachers, followed by a polite bill for damages. Quentin's desk was right beside the window, a necessity since he spent very little time in doing paperwork. That's what he had clerks for, and a great deal of time in overseeing the pupils and classes. Some of that overseeing was conducted from his desk, an advantage mages had over mercenary captains. He could look in on virtually anything he chose, at any time, simply by exercising a little of the power that came with the rank of Master Mage. Just now he was keeping an eye on the road, in between considering the proposed theses of four would-be journeymen. The messenger had departed early this morning. Since then he'd been waiting for the personage. Not with impatience. A mage soon learned the futility of impatience, but with growing curiosity. He wasn't certain what to expect, really. On rereading the note, he saw that Carol had said that he should give this girl training, something he hadn't taken a great deal of notice of the first time around. Now, that was interesting. Carol herself was not a mage, but she had somehow managed to spot potential mages in the past and send them to either him or her uncle. Had she seen something in this girl? Or was it simply something the girl herself wanted? Had she absorbed tales of what Carol's mages had done until she had convinced herself that she, too, could become a mage? Well, that was possible, but not without the talent for it, unless you could see and manipulate the energies mages used. She could fret herself blue without getting anywhere. Even those who followed the blood paths had at least a little of the talent. There were varying degrees in what mages could do, too. Not only did the strength of the talent vary, thus dictating how much energy a mage could handle, but the kind of talent varied, thus dictating the kind of energy he could handle. Some never became more than earth mages and hedge wizards, using their own life energies to sense what was going on in the world around them, augmenting the natural attributes of plants and animals to serve them, and healing. Not that there was anything wrong with that. Quentin himself had seen some very impressive merc work done by hedge wizards, with a firm grasp of their abilities and a determination to make the most of them. The tiniest change at the right moment can down a king, or an army. But he rather doubted that being told she would never be anything other than a hedge wizard would satisfy a headstrong princess, nor would being told she could not be any kind of a mage at all. He was prepared for just about anything, or so he told himself, from a spoiled brat who thought a white uniform and a coronet entitled her to anything she wanted, to a naive child with no mage talent whatsoever, but many dreams, to someone very like some of his older pupils. That would be the best scenario in many ways, to have her turn out to be teachable, with mage talent present, but unused, so that he could give her what she wanted, but would not have to force her to unlearn bad habits. Theoretically, the discipline required by the Herald's mind magic would carry over and give her a head start over talented youngsters who had yet to learn the value of discipline. A flash of white on the road, just below the gate, alerted him, and he paused for a moment, the key in his mage sight. That in particular had improved out of all recognition since joining the Skybolts and his elevation to master class. If this child had any ability at all, he would be able to see it, even from the tower. Then he would know what to tell her if she asked for training, and he'd have some time to think about just how he was going to phrase it, be it good news or bad. Two dazzlingly white-clad riders on pure white horses entered the main gate and paused for a moment in the yard before dismounting. And that was when Quentin got one of the greatest shocks of his life. Whatever he had been expecting, it wasn't what he saw. The ordinary young woman with a graceful white horse was not ordinary at all. She was the bearer of an untrained but major mage gift, one so powerful that sheathed her in a closely wrapped, sparkling aura in his mage sight that briefly touched everyone around her with exploratory fingers she was apparently unaware of. Quentin was astonished and surprised she hadn't caused problems with it before this. Surely she must have seen power flows, energy levels, even the nodes that he could see but could not use. Surely she had wondered what they were, and how could she not have been tempted to try and manipulate them? Then he recalled something. These heralds, one and all, had mind magic and were trained in it. If they didn't know what mage talent was, it could possibly be mistaken for something like sight. And if she was told that this was just another way of viewing things, that she could not actually affect them, she might not have caused any trouble. They have no idea how close they came, if she had ever been tempted to touch something. That was not the end of the surprises. She was carrying at her side something that radiated such power that it almost eclipsed her, and only long familiarity with Caro's sword enabled him to recognize it as need. The sword had changed, had awakened somehow, and it was totally transformed from the relatively simple blade he had dealt with. Now there was no doubt whatsoever that it was a major magical artifact, and it radiated controlled power that rivaled the adepts he knew. It's a good thing I never tried mucking around with it when it was like this. It probably would have swatted me like a fly. He wondered how he could have missed it when they were riding in. It must have been like a beacon, and how the mages at Farum's court could have missed it. He had his answer, as it simply stopped what it was doing. It went back to being the simple sword he had known. Magical, yes, if you looked at it closely enough, but you had to look very closely and know what you were looking for. Did it put on that show for my benefit? He wondered. Somehow that idea was a little chilling. No one he knew could detect mage sight in action. It was a passive spell, not an active one. No one he knew. That didn't mean it couldn't be done. That notion was even more awe-inspiring than the display of power had been. Need was old. Perhaps the ancient ways of magic it was made with harbored spells he couldn't even dream of. The creature she was riding, not a horse at all, even if it chose to appear as one, rivaled both the young woman and the sword, but in a way few would have recognized. The aura enveloping it was congruent with the creature's skin, as if controlled power was actually shining through the skin, which was very much the case. Although few mages would have known it for what it was, Quentin recognized it as a guardian spirit of the highest order, and from the colors of its aura, it was superior even to the ethereal spirits he had once, very briefly, had conversation with when some of the Shinnain relatives came to Bolthaven for the annual horse fair, the ones Carol's other uncle called Spirit Kalenadral, that served the Shinnain goddess. The Veiled Ones, Shaman Krahira had called them, the unspoken implication being that only the spirit Kalenadral went veiled. They were to this horse what an eating knife is to a perfectly balanced rapier. One blow after another, all within a heartbeat, he practically swallowed his tongue with shock and dropped his arms numbly to his sides. For a moment, he felt like an apprentice again, faced with his master and the vision of what that master had become after years and years of work in developing his talent to its highest pinnacle placed before him. All that power, all that potential, and he hadn't the slightest idea what to do with it. His mind completely froze for a moment as he stared at her. "I can't take her on," his thoughts babbled in panic. "One slip, and she wouldn't just blow up the workshop. She could. And that guardian, and the sword, and... Only years of self-discipline, combined with more years of learning to think on his feet with the skybolts, enabled him to get his mind working again so that he could stop reacting and start acting like a mage and a competent master, instead of a dumbfounded apprentice. And the first thing he did was to turn away from the window. With her out of his sight and sight, he was able to take a deep breath, run his hand through his sweat-damp hair, and think. Quickly, he had to come up with an answer and a solution. One thing was certain. It wasn't a question of whether she could be trained or not. She had to be trained. One day, she might be tempted to try to manipulate some of the energies she could sense all around her. And then... No telling what would happen. Depends on what she touched and how hard she pulled. It could be even worse if she were in a desperate situation and she simply reacted instinctively, trying to save herself or others, with a thrust of fear driving her. Gods, and the very first thing we are taught is never, ever act in fear or anger. She would be easy prey for anyone who saw her and wanted to use her. There were bloodpath masters and even adepts out there who wouldn't hesitate to lure her into their territory with promises of training and then exploit her ruthlessly, willing or not. Anyone could be broken, and no mage had gotten to the master level without learning the patience it took to break someone and subvert them, even if it took a year or more. No, she had to be trained. Now the question was, by whom? Carol said, if I couldn't handle her, to send her on to old Jendar, her uncle. He's an adept. Hellfires, he taught me. He ought to be able to handle anyone. He can deal with her. I don't have to. That burden off his hands, he sighed and relaxed. Gradually, the sweat of panic dried. His heart went back to its sedate pace. His muscles unknotted. The problem was solved, but he wasn't going to have to be the one to solve it. He was glad now that he delegated one of the teachers, a very discreet young lady who was, bless the gods, an herbalist healer earth witch with no mage sight worth speaking of, to greet them when they arrived, just in case he suddenly found himself with his hands full. God only knows what I'd have been like if I'd met them at the gate. Babbling, probably. Hardly one to inspire confidence. By the time word reached him that they had arrived, he was back to being the calm, unruffled image of a schoolmaster, completely in control of everything around him. "Yes," he said. The child poked his head inside cautiously. All the apprentices were cautious when the master was in his office. Quentin had been known to have odd things loose in the room on occasion, just to keep people from interrupting him. The legend of the constable's scorched backside was told in the dormitory even yet, and that had happened the first year the school had been founded. "Sir, the people you expected are here. The lady's name's Elspeth. The gentleman is Skip, Elrodi says. If you're able, sir, you should come down, Elrodi says." The child looked the way he must have a few moments ago. It wasn't often an apprentice got to see the inside of the master's office. Usually he met the youngsters on their own ground, and when he wasn't actually in the office, he kept it mage-locked, for his office also served as his secondary workroom. There were things in here no apprentice should ever get his hands on.
"I'll be right there," he said.
The child vanished. He waited a few moments, more to be certain his stomach had settled, then turned and started down the stairs. By the time he reached the ground, he felt close to normal and was able to absorb the shock of his visitor's appearance without turning a hair. Outwardly, anyway. The sword was quiet, but the girl and her so-called horse weren't.
So long as they don't do anything.
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.
Side 5. Winds of Fate by Mercedes Lackey. Continuing on page 177.
He turned first to greet the young lady, as her companion held back a little, diffidently, confirming his guess that she was much higher ranked than he was. And given her strong family resemblance to King Pharam, she was undoubtedly the Elspeth that was heir to the Valdemar throne. She took after the dark side of the family rather than the blonde, but the resemblance was there beyond a doubt. To all outward appearances, she was no different than any other young, well-born woman of his acquaintance. Wavy brown hair was confined in a braid that trailed down her back, though bits of it escaped to form little tendrils at her ears. Her square face was not beautiful or even conventionally pretty and doll-like. It was a face that was so full of character and personality that beauty would have been superfluous and mere prettiness eclipsed. Like Carol, she was handsome and vividly alive. Her brown eyes sparkled when she talked. Her generous mouth smiled often. If he hadn't had mage sight, he would have guessed that she had mage talent in abundance. She had that kind of energy about her. She'd studied her Rethwellen. That was evident from her lack of accent. "I am very glad to meet you at last," she said when she'd been introduced. "I'm Caro's problem child, Master Quentin. She's told me a lot about you, and since she's a pretty rotten correspondent, I guess you're rather in the dark about me." Her smile widened. "I know what her letters are like. The last time she was with the Skybolt, there was a flood that got half the town, and all she wrote was, 'It's a little wet here. Be back when I can.'" He chuckled.
"Well, she neglected to supply me with your name, and she kept calling you a personage. I expect that was for reasons of security. You are the Elspeth, I think you are, the one with a mother named Selene."
Elspeth nodded and made a face. "I'm afraid so. That was part of what I meant by being a problem child. Sorry, can't help who my parents are. Born into it. Oh, this is Skiff. He's also assigned to this job."
"By which she's tactfully saying that my chief duty is to play bodyguard," Skiff said, holding out his hand.
Quentin released his mage sight just a little and breathed a silent sigh of relief. This young man was perfectly ordinary. No magical artifacts, no adept potential. Except that he was also riding a guardian spirit. Not as exalted a spirit as the girl's, but... The mayor turned, looked him straight in the eye, and gave him a broad and unmistakable wink. He stifled a gasp, felt the blood drain from his face, then plastered a pleasant smile on his lips and managed not to stammer. "Since there is only one Elspeth with a mother by that name that I know of, that Caro would have been so secretive about, I can understand why you are in that role," he said. "It's necessary."
"I know it is," they both said, and laughed.
Quentin noted that they both had hearty, unforced laughs, the laughter of people who did not fear a joke. Elspeth made a face, and Skiff shrugged.
"We know it's necessary," Skiff replied for both of them. "But that doesn't mean Elspeth much likes it."
Quentin had not missed the sword calluses on her hands, and the easy way she wore her blade. She had the muscles of a practiced fighter, too, though she didn't have the toughened, hard-eyed look the female mercs had after their first year in the ranks. He coughed politely.
Caro did, at least, tell me what brings you here. And I have to be honest with you. I wish I could help you, but I can't. None of my teachers are interested in anything but teaching, and none of the youngsters ready to go out as journeymen are up to trying to cross your borders and dealing with the magical guards of that border. I assume you know about that. I couldn't pass it when Caro first took the Skybolts north, and I don't know that I could now that I'm a more practiced master with years in the rank.
Elspeth's face fell. Skiff simply looked resigned.
"What about you teaching us?" she asked, almost wistfully. "I mean, I don't suppose either of us are teachable, are we?"
Do I tell her right now? He thought about that quickly. Well, it couldn't do any harm to tell her a little about her abilities right off. It might make her a little more cautious. "I'm afraid Skiff isn't, but, young lady, you are potentially a very good mage. Your potential is so high, in fact, that I simply don't feel up to teaching you myself. And you have to be taught. There is absolutely no doubt about that."
Her face was a study in contradictory emotions. Surprise warred with disappointment. Elation with... was it fear? He hoped so. She would do well to fear that kind of power.
"I don't have the time," he said truthfully. "You're coming to the teaching late in your life, and as strong as you could be, well, it will require a very personal teaching. One-to-one, in fact, with someone who will be able to deal with your mistakes, and I can't do it. It would take time away from the students I've already promised to teach. That wouldn't be fair to them. And I gather that you're under some time considerations?"
Both of them nodded, and Elspeth's horse snorted as if in agreement.
"Dearest gods, it's looking at me the way old Jendar used to when I wasn't up to doing a particular task and said so. Like it's telling me, at least you know when not to be stupid. It wouldn't be fair to you to give you less attention than you need, especially given that."
Her shoulders sagged and her expression turned bleak.
"So I've come on a fool's errand, then?" "Not at all," he hastened to assure her. "What I can and will do is send you on to my old master, Caro's uncle, Adept Jendar. He's no longer teaching in his school. He will, on occasion, take on a very talented pupil like yourself. But without my directions, introduction, and safe conduct, you'd never find him. He's very reclusive." "I don't suppose we could get him to come back with us, could we?" Skiff asked hopefully. "That would solve all our problems."
Quentin shrugged.
"I don't know. He's very old. But, on the other hand, magic tends to preserve mages. I haven't seen him in years, and he may still be just as active as he always was. He's certainly my superior in ability and knowledge. He's just as canny and hard to predict as Caro, and I won't even attempt to second-guess him. The best I can offer is, ask him yourself."
Skiff looked a great deal more cheerful.
"Thanks, Master Quentin. We will."
Quentin felt as if a tremendous burden had just been lifted from his shoulders.
There's nothing quite like being able to legitimately pass the responsibility, he thought wryly. And, feeling a good deal more cheerful himself, he told both of them, "Even if I can't offer you the dubious benefits of my teaching, I can still offer the hospitality of the school. You will stay for at least a night, won't you? I'd love to hear what Caro's been up to lately." "You're right, by the way," he concluded, turning with a smile for Elspeth. "She's a terrible correspondent. Her letter about you was less than half a page. The letter I'm going to give you for Jendar is going to be at least 5 pages long, and I don't even know you that well."
The young woman chuckled and gave him a wink that was the mirror image of the one Skiff's spirit horse had given him. He racked his brain for the right name for them. Comrades? No, companions, that was it.
"I can even offer something in the way of suitable housing for your, friends," he said, bowing a little in their direction. "Your companions, I believe you call them. I don't know what kind of treatment they're accustomed to at home, but I can at least arrange something civilized."
Elspeth looked surprised at that,
but the companions themselves looked gratified, like queens in exile who had discovered that someone, at last, was going to give them their proper due. "We have two loose boxes with their own little paddock, and you can fix the latch string on the inside so that they can open and shut it themselves," he said, hastily, trying to look as if he had visits from guardian spirits all the time. "Kero always had a Shinnein war steeds, you know, and they needed that kind of treatment. They aren't companions, of course, but they're a great deal more intelligent than horses." "That's lovely," Elspeth said as he fell silent, her gratitude quite genuine. "That really is. I can't tell you how hard it is, even in Valdemar, to find someone who doesn't think they're just horses."
"Oh, no, my lady," he replied fervently,
convinced by the lurking humor in both sets of blue eyes that the companions found him and his reactions to them very amusing.
"Oh, no, I promise you. I know only too well that they aren't horses."
"And you don't know the half of it, friend," whispered a voice in his mind. For a moment he wasn't certain he'd actually heard that. Then the light of amusement in the nearest one's eyes convinced him that he had. "I think I should ignore that. If they wanted me to treat them like heavenly visitors, they wouldn't look like horses, would they? Or would they? Do the heralds know what they are? If they don't, no, I don't think I'd better tell them. If the companions want them to know, they'll know. If not, no, it would not be a good idea to go against the wishes of a guardian spirit. In fact, it would be a very stupid idea." He realized that he was babbling to himself now and decided to delegate the tour of the stables and school to someone else. He was going to need a chance to relax before he dealt with these two again. Dinner, held without being under those disturbing blue eyes, was far easier. They exclaimed over his mage life and over the tame little fire elemental that kept the ham and bread warm and melted their cheese for them if they chose. They marveled at a few of his other little luxuries, like the stoves instead of fireplaces, which kept his quarters much warmer in winter, even without the aid of more fire elementals. He exchanged stories with them of what he knew of Kero and Farum and Darren, from the old days with the Skybolts, and what Kero was up to now, at least, as a herald. He actually got quite a bit of useful court gossip from her. She knew what to look and listen for. But he even got more from Skiff, who evidently didn't miss anything. That young man bore watching. He reminded Quentin of another one of the Shinnein, one he knew was trained as an assassin, who'd been one of the Skybolt specialist instructors for a while, an instructor in techniques he knew, without being told, that he didn't want to know anything about. There was a great deal more to Skiff than met the eye. Quentin had the feeling that he was not only very resourceful, he could probably be quite dangerous. He also had the feeling that Skiff's presence had a great deal to do with the reason why Elspeth hadn't been bothered by mages eager to use her before this. Elspeth was, he discovered, an extremely well-spoken young lady, but in many ways she was still a girl. She knew how she was treated inside Valdemar, and how her rank worked within that kingdom, but had very little notion of how knowledge of her rank would affect people, for good or ill, outside it, or how they could and would exploit her, given the chance. "You see," Skiff said, after he'd explained some of the ways in which she would have to be careful around local nobility, "I told you it was complicated down here." She made a face, and the mage light picked up golden glints in her eyes as she turned toward her partner. "You told me a lot of things, and some of them I was right about." Quentin intervened. "It's not her fault, Skiff. She's always dealt with very highly ranked nobles. It's the local lordlings you have to be really careful with around here. I'd say that half of them were never born to their titles, or at least weren't the first sons. They didn't get where they are now by being nice, and most of them want to climb a lot higher before they die. You can't even count on blood relations, to be honest with you. Well, take Carol's brother, for instance. He's all right, but the Lady Deanna is pretty much an information siphon for her relatives. And there are a couple of them that none of us trust, not even the king. Go to Lordan, and within half a day every one of Dierna's relatives will know that something brought heralds down out of Valdemar. Let Lordan know who and what you are,
and I personally wouldn't vouch for your safety once you got off his land. Ransom is too tempting a prospect.
Huh, was Skiff's only comment. He reached for another piece of smoked ham thoughtfully. There were odd markings on his hands, old scars that looked like they might have been left by knife fights.
Interesting, Quentin thought. A strange sort of partner for a princess. For Skiff was a partner, and not just a bodyguard. The body language of both of them said that. More than a partner. A lover, maybe? That seemed likely at first. Then again, maybe not. They were both heralds, and the little he'd managed to pry out of Caro on the subject indicated that heralds had an even closer brotherhood than the tightest merc company. Emotionally, sexually, whether the two were lovers didn't bear any thought after that. They were heralds, and that was a good enough answer for Quentin. Even if you were left alone, they'd find a way to use your presence, he continued. Believe me, the more you act like common folk, the better off you are.
He waited for understanding to dawn, then said, patiently but forcefully,
Get out of the white outfits.
Skiff snickered. Elspeth simply looked bewildered.
Look, common people don't ride around in immaculate white outfits. The horses are bad enough. Add the uniforms, and you might as well hire barkers to announce you in every little village. I'll get you some clothes before you leave. Save the white stuff for when you need to impress someone. Your simple presence as someone's guest could lend weight to some quarrel they have that you know nothing about.
And I wish there was a way to dye the companions, too. But I'm afraid the amount of magic energy they have simply by being on this plane is going to bleach them again before they get half a day down the road. That's assuming dye would take, which I wouldn't bet on.
Elspeth sighed and finally nodded a reluctant agreement.
Damn, being able to pull rank on someone who was being stupid would have been awfully useful.
All right. You know more about the way things are around here than we do.
That's why he's got Bolthaven as a freehold of the king, Skiff put in unexpectedly. As long as it's a freehold, none of the locals can try and bully each other by claiming he's with them.
He turned to Quentin, gesturing with a piece of cheese.
Am I right?
Exactly, he replied, pleased with Skiff's understanding. Not that anyone who knew anything about magic would ever suspect a White Wind school of being on anyone's side. We don't do things that way.
Skiff grinned crookedly.
I kind of got that impression from Caro that you folks were the closest thing there was to heralds down here.
Oh, he replied lightly, trying to keep away from that subject. The Brotherhood of the White Wind's mages wasn't something he wanted to confide to an outsider. There were things about White Wind's people that weren't shared by any other mage school, and they wanted to keep it that way.
We aren't that close.
I'll second that, whispered that voice in his mind. He started involuntarily.
So what exactly are these mage schools anyway? Skiff persisted, showing no notice of his momentary startlement. I mean, some of you are real schools, and some of you seem to be philosophies, if you catch my meaning.
We're both, he replied, wondering who or what had spoken.
Surely not the companions. Surely he would have detected them listening in on the conversation.
Wouldn't he?
Each method of teaching is a philosophy, he continued, mind alert for other intrusions. We differ in how we use our magic and how we are willing to obtain power.
How much should he tell them, and how much should he leave in Jendar's hands?
Better stick to the basics.
White Wind takes nothing without permission, and we try to do the least amount of harm we can. We also think that since mage talent is an accident of birth, we have the obligation to use it for the sake of those who were never born with it.
Then he grinned. But there's no reason why a mage can't make a living at the same time, so long as he doesn't knowingly use his powers to abet repression or aid others who abuse their powers.
But that's why you don't find many White Wind mages working with mercenary companies. When you're a merc, you can't guarantee that you're going to be working for the right side.
At least we don't have to worry about that, Elspeth said.
Skiff simply raised an eyebrow, and Quentin had the distinct feeling that Skiff was debating how much to tell him. "I assume you've heard of Blood Path Mages?" he asked, and was surprised when Skiff shook his head.
"Oh, hellfire! I guess I had better tell you, then. They're mages who take their power from others."
He waited expectantly for them to make the connection, then added, a little impatiently,
"by killing them, usually painfully, and by breaking and using them, if they have the time to spare."
Elspeth's eyes widened. "That's what Ankar is doing, or at least that's what some of the people who've escaped from Hardorn say he and his mages are doing. I didn't know there was a name for them." Skiff scowled.
"So, which school teaches people to do that?"
he asked, growling a little.
Quentin shrugged.
"There are schools, but the moment anyone finds out about them, they're destroyed.
If the mages haven't scattered first, which is what usually happens, no sane ruler wants that on his soil. But to tell you the truth, that kind of magic usually isn't taught in a school. It's usually one-to-one. A blood path mage who decides to take an apprentice just goes looking for one. They try to find people who have potential but are untrained."
"And can't tell one mage from another?"
Skiff asked, with a hard look at him. Quentin nodded. Skiff had already seen what he was driving at.
"Sometimes.
Sometimes they look for someone who is impatient, who is power-hungry and ruthless. That's the kind that usually rebels eventually, has a confrontation with his master, and either dies, wins, or has a draw that both walk away from. And that is how they reproduce themselves, basically."
Quentin did not mention what happened in the first example. He decided, all things considered, it was better to wait until Elspeth was gone.
"Now there's one thing I have to warn you about, and it's back to the same old story of, you aren't in Valdemar anymore. For every rule, there's an exception, and this is the one to blood magic. There are perfectly good people that practice a couple of forms of magic that require a blood sacrifice. The Shinnain shamans, for one. Sometimes they spill their own blood, just a little, because any spillage of blood releases a lot of power. And in times of a very dire problem, a shaman or swordsworn may actually volunteer as a sacrifice, as a kind of messenger to their goddess that things are very bad, they need help, and they are willing to give up a lot to get it."
Elspeth's eyes got very wide at that.
"You're joking."
Quentin shook his head.
"I am not joking. It's very serious for them. It hasn't happened in the last 3 or 4 generations. And the last time it did, the plains were in the middle of a drought that had dried even the springs. People and herds were dying. One of the shamans threw himself off the top of the cliffs that ring the plains, right down onto an altar he'd set up down there."
"And?"
Skiff asked.
"And the drought ended. They say that he roams the skies of the plains as a spirit bird now. Some even say he transformed as he fell, that he never actually hit the ground."
It was Quentin's turn to shrug.
"I'm not their goddess. It's not my place to make decisions. What's better, answer every little yelp for help, or make people prove they need it?"
"I don't know,"
Skiff admitted. Elspeth just bit her lip and looked distressed.
"But I can see what you mean. We really aren't home, are we? There's a lot of gray out here, and precious little black and white."
Quentin replied with a hint of a smile.
"The Shinnain aren't the only odd ones, either. They're the Hawk Brothers, what the Shinnain call Tela Adras. Nobody except the Shinnain shamans knows anything about them, mostly because they tend to kill anybody that ventures into their territories."
Skiff scrutinized him closely for a moment.
"If you're waiting for a gasp of horror, Master Quentin, you aren't going to get one. There's a reason you told us this, and it has to do with the situation not being black and white. So, why do they kill people who walk across their little boundary lines?"
Quentin chuckled.
"Caught me, didn't you? All right, there's a reason that I think is a perfectly good one, and to be honest, they will try and turn you back. It's only if you persist that they'll kill you.
The Shinnin say that they are the guardians of very destructive magics, that they purify a place of these magics, then move on, and that they kill persistent intruders so that those intruders can't get their hands on that magic. Seems like a good reason to me. Skip nodded. Any evidence to support this? Quentin raised an eyebrow. Well, their territories are all in the Pelicus, and there are more weird, twisted, and just plain evil things in there than you could ever imagine. And they do periodically vanish from a place and never come back. And once they're gone, anybody that moves in never has trouble from the oddling things again. So, your guess is just as valid as mine. I'd believe the Shinnin, personally. Skip's eyes were thoughtful, but he didn't say anything. Elspeth stifled a yawn at that moment and looked apologetic. It isn't the stories or the company, Master Quentin, she said ruefully. It's the long ride and the wonderful meal. We started before dawn, and we got here just before sunset. That's a long day in the saddle. Skip's used to it, but I'm a lot softer, I'm afraid. Well, I can't blame you for that, Quentin chuckled. The truth is, I'm not up to a day in the saddle myself anymore. Why don't you find that bed I showed you? I was thinking of calling it a night myself. Thanks, she said, and finished the last of the wine in her glass, then pushed herself away from the table. She gave Skip an opaque look, but didn't say anything. Good night, then, Quentin supplied. I'll see you off in the morning, unless you want to stay longer. No, we're going to have to cover a lot of ground, and we're short on time, she replied absently, then smiled. But thank you for the offer. Good night. Skip looked after her for a moment after the door had closed, then turned to Quentin. There's something else you didn't want her to hear, he said, about those bloodpath mages. What is it? A little startled by Skiff's directness, Quentin came straight to the point. It's about the ones who are looking for an apprentice, or at least they call it that, who is untrained but powerful. The ones looking for someone who is totally naive about magic, like your young friend there. Skiff nodded, his eyes hardening. Go on. What they're looking for is the exact opposite of someone like themselves. They have two ways of operating, and both involve subversion. He paused to gather his thoughts. The first is to corrupt the innocent. Not possible, Skip interjected. Trust me on that one. If you've ever heard that heralds are incorruptible, believe it. Well, anyone who rides around on a guardian spirit probably is, no matter what people say about everyone having a price. I suppose heralds do, too, but it's not the kind of price a bloodpath mage could meet. Well, the other is destruction, luring the innocent into a place of power, then breaking him, or her. Quentin gave Skip a sharp look. And don't tell me that you can't be broken. Anyone can be broken. And a bloodpath mage has all the knowledge, patience, and means to do so. Their places of power are usually so well guarded that it would take a small army to get in, usually at a terrible cost, and by the time they do, it's usually too late. That's if you can find the place, because besides being protected, it will also be well hidden. Skip had the grace to blanch a little. Nice little kingdom you have here. Oh, there aren't ever a lot of that kind, but they do exist, Quentin replied, and that's why I'm warning you. You don't have the ability to see the kind of potential she carries. But I do, and so will anyone else of my rank who happens to see her. That's master and above. And there are not only bloodpath masters, there are adepts. Trust me on that. One of those would be able to persuade you that he was your long-lost best friend if you weren't completely on the alert for someone like that. In fact, the truth is that unless you've got introductions like I'm going to give you, I would be very wary of anyone who seems friendly. The friendlier they are, the warier I'd be. There isn't a mage out here who has to go looking for pupils. They come to him. It's a matter of the way things work. Power calls to power. So if someone is out looking, it usually isn't for anyone's purposes but his own. The only people as a group that you can trust without hesitation are the Shinnin and whoever they vouch for. Anyone else is suspect.
Skip's eyes narrowed. And you say she looks attractive? Quentin nodded soberly.
I hate to send you to bed with a thought guaranteed to create nightmares, but yes, more than attractive. To put it bluntly, my friend, you are riding out into wolf territory with a young and tender lamb at your side, and the wolves can look convincingly like sheep.
Skip licked his lips, and the look in his eyes convinced Quentin that he hadn't been wrong.
This man was very dangerous, if he chose to be, and he had just chosen to be. Quentin could only hope the man was dangerous enough.
Chapter 10, Dark Wind. Bree dove down out of the sky with no warning whatsoever, coming straight out of the sun so that Darkwind didn't spot him until the last possible second, seeing only the flash of shadow crossing the ground.
Trevan, look out! He shouted, interrupting whatever it was Hydona was about to say.
Trevan ducked and flattened his crest, and Bree skimmed right over his head, his outstretched claws just missing the quill he'd been aiming for. Then, without faltering in the slightest, he altered his course with a single wingbeat and shot back up toward the clouds, vanishing to the apparent size of a sparrow in a heartbeat. That was the single bad habit Darkwind had never been able to break him of. The gyre was endlessly fascinated by Trevan's crest feathers and kept trying to snatch them whenever the griffin wasn't careful about watching for him.
"Sorry," Darkwind said apologetically. I don't know what gets into him. I really don't.
Hydona smothered a smirk. Trevan looked up at the bird, who was now just a dot in the sky, innocently riding a thermal, as if he had never even thought about snatching Trevan's feathers, and growled,
Dark Wind, I do love you, but someday I am going to swat that bird of yours.
Hydona made an odd whistling sound, half-choked. Trevan transferred his glare to his mate.
Sorry, Darkwind repeated feebly.
Hydona, you were saying... Oh, that there seems no reason for the changed child to have saved the Dyheli.
Hydona's eyes still held a spark of mirth as Trevan flattened his crest as closely to his skull as he could. Unless she truly meant to be altruistic. And I suppose you could not judge how powerful a mage she is?
He shook his head. Not on the basis of a single spell. If I were an adept trying to worm my way into a clan, I'd probably try and make myself look as harmless as possible, actually.
She is other...
Trevan said, unexpectedly. Both Darkwind and his mate looked at him in surprise.
It is the claws. Those cannot be changed from human-based, only bred in. Which means that she is other, for the claws come from the unhuman, and only the others breed with them. So she is other, at least in part.
Hydona nodded slowly. That is true. I had forgotten that. Darkwind bit back a curse. That would make her even harder to slip past his father if he had to. A changed child he might accept, with difficulty, but one who was even in part of the others, the bloodpath mages of the Outlands, not a chance.
But if she's other, what was she doing that close to Kashena? He asked.
Trevan ruffled his feathers in the griffin equivalent of a shrug.
It seems obvious that she could have many motives.
True. Darkwind could think of several. She could be a spy. She could still have been trying to escape a cruel master. She could even be an adept herself and have inflicted all those hurts on herself with the intent of lulling their suspicions.
We could, Hydona offered unexpectedly, question her for you. We are as effective as the Vrondi in sensing falsehood. It is instinct.
They are. That was news to him, though welcome news. Somehow the Griffins kept pulling these little surprises out of nowhere, keeping him in a perpetual state of astonishment.
That would be damned useful, he replied honestly. The truth spell is still a spell, and I don't want to use it. Not this close to the border. I can't chance attracting things to the Hertasi settlement, or to Kashena either.
It is instinct with us, Treyvan repeated to reassure him. Not a spell. Perhaps, though, you ought to be there also. She will probably be very afraid of us.
He smiled. Considering that you're large enough to really bite her head off if you wanted to.
You're probably right, he said. And that might not be a bad thing either. If we keep her frightened, we have a better chance of catching her in a lie, don't we?
Yes, Treyvan agreed. It does not affect the truth as we sense it. Fear.
Good. I'll be with you, so that she doesn't try to run. But you two loom a little bit. Be the big bad monsters, and I'll be her protector.
But another thought occurred to him then. He'd been planning on what to do to find out more about her. He still had no idea what to do with her.
What can I do with her if she seems all right, he asked. I can't possibly take her into the Vale.
Worry about that when, and if, the time comes,
Treyvan said quietly. It is easy to make a decision about a friend. I would worry more about how to dispose of her. If she is false, leave her to us. If you like. We can't dispatch her.
No, he said quickly. No, that's my job.
It made him sick to think of killing in cold blood, but it was his job, and he would not put the burden on someone else.
Not them, especially. There's such an innocence about them. I won't see it stained with a cold-blooded murder, no matter how casually they think of doing it.
It would matter to me. Even if it doesn't seem to matter to them.
Treyvan shrugged.
Very well, then, he said.
Shall we meet you there?
Fine, he replied, and couldn't help but grin. Even if it does mean another trek through the marsh. The things I do for duty.
Treyvan just laughed and spread his wings.
Just keep that bird from my crest. He begins to look tasty.
And as Darkwin turned to head back, he was mortally certain that the Griffin was thinking of all those quill-snatching attempts by Vree, and chuckling at the notion of dining on the poor gyre. The Griffins were very Catholic in what they considered edible. Just as Vree would happily dine on a kestrel, a fellow raptor, the Griffins would probably be just as willing to make a morsel of Vree. Except that Vree was Darkwin's. That alone was saving him from becoming Treyvan's lunch. In reality, if not in thought.
Featherhead, he mind spoke up to the dot in the blue, you have no notion how close to the cliff you've been flying.
Cliff? Responded Bree, puzzled.
What cliff? Where cliff?
I can't tell if he's playing coy or he really doesn't understand me.
Darkwin sighed and waded into the murky water. Never mind. Just stop teasing the Griffins. Leave Treyvan's feathers alone. You hear me?
Yes, said Vree slyly.
Yes, that he'd heard Darkwin. Not that he'd obey.
Darkwin groaned.
No wonder Father doesn't listen to me. I can't even get respect from a bird.
Nera met him at the edge of the swamp, popping up out of nowhere right into his path and scaring a year out of him. He yelped. One foot slipped off the path and into who knew how deep, smelly water, and he teetered precariously for a moment before regaining his balance. He glared at the Hertasi, snarling silently. Nera blithely ignored the glare.
The winged ones are here, he mind spoke. The creature you brought is also awake.
And with that, he vanished again,
melting back into the reeds. Darkwing closed his eyes for a moment and tried to think charitable thoughts. He let me leave the girl here, and he's worried because of her, the threat she represents. He was startled to see the griffins. He's preoccupied with other things. He forgets that I'm a lot clumsier in the swamp than he is. He grimaced. Sure he does. And I'm the Shin-In goddess. Not that it mattered. Nothing was going to change Nira. The Hirtasi was far too fond of playing his little games of eccentric old creature, and insisting that if Darkwind really tried, he could move as well as the Hirtasi could in the swamp. He enjoyed watching Darkwind come out of the reeds covered in muck. Vree, Nira, Dawnfire, the Griffins. With friends like these, why do I need to look on the border for trouble? All I need to do is sit and wait. They'll bring trouble to me. But he did hurry his steps a little, as much as he dared, without losing his footing. Nira would not have come looking for him if the Hirtasi weren't at least a little worried, truly worried about the changed child. And rightly, it was possible the girl was an adept. She seemed a little young for the rank, but Darkwind had just attained adept class when the Heartstone fractured, and he had been younger. And it didn't follow that she was as youthful as she looked. One of the commonest changes for a Bloodpath adept to make in himself was to remove years. Most of them kept their bodies looking as if they were in their mid-twenties, but some even chose to look like children. Those were the really nasty ones for Taladras to cope with. Given the Hawk Brothers' strong reaction to children, it was easy to play on their emotions until the enemy adept had them in exactly the position he wanted them. Kavala had been decimated by an adept using that ploy several hundred years ago, back when their territory was on the eastern shore of the Great Crater Sea, the one the Outlanders called Lake Evendim now. Their lesson was one no Taladras could afford to ignore. He found himself thinking of his options if she was an adept, and how he might be able to trick her into revealing her abilities. She'll have to pull power from the nearest node just to heal herself, he thought, as he felt his way along the submerged path. Trevan should be able to sense that, if she does. From what he told me, he's tied his magic into that node. If she's a master, she'll draw from the ley line. That's going to be subtler and harder to catch. If he had someone trap the line so that any interference would be noted, she might note it as well. What he needed was a sensitive, someone who was so attuned to the local energy flows that he would notice any deviation from the norm. Wait a moment. Didn't Trevan tell me that the Griffliths are sensitive to the power flows in their birth area? That might work, assuming he can convince them to keep their minds on it. He tried to think of something that would have convinced him to keep a constant watch for something when he was that young, and failed to come up with anything. Children were children, and generally as feather-headed as Bree. Well, I'll mention it to the adults and see what they say. He emerged from the reeds to the walkways rimming the rice paddies, and stopped long enough to dry his feet and put his boots back on. A quick look around showed him nothing amiss, which meant there had been no real need to hurry, only Nira's impatience. Old coot just likes to see me lose my balance, and he's not happy unless he's the one in charge of everything. He knew Nira was watching him, and he deliberately took his time. On the hill above Nira's tunnel, two pairs of huge waving wings told him that Trevan and Idona were waiting too, but with more patience than the little Hirtasi. He picked his way across the paddies, taking time to be courteous to the farmers who bent so earnestly over their plants. One of them even stopped him to ask a few questions about one of his kin who lived in the vale. And he could sense Nira's impatient glare, even from the distant tunnel mouth. He looked up, and sure enough, there was a shadow, just within the round entrance to the tunnel. He smiled sweetly at it, and bent to answer the Hirtasi's questions, in detail and with extreme politeness. After all, he was the only Taladras any of them saw regularly, and he did make a point to keep track of those Vale Hirtasi, with relatives out here. They were so shy that they seldom asked him about their Vale kin, and it was only fair to give them a full answer when they did inquire. And if Nira says anything, that's exactly what I'll tell him. When he reached the hill and set foot on the carefully graveled trail leading up the side, he debated on going first to Nera's tunnel. But Trayvan's mind-spoken hail decided him in favor of the griffins instead. It seemed that his charge was not only awake, but moving. "Featherless son, your prize waits up here. She can walk, slowly, and there is more room for us up here. She did not ask what we were, and does not seem particularly frightened."
"Well, that was a little disappointing. She must have known about you, or else she's seen griffins before. So much for you playing monster. I'm on my way up."
When he reached the top of the sun-gilded bluff, he found his charge reclining on another of the stuffed grass mats, neatly bracketed between the two griffins. They were also reclining in the cool, short grass, wings half open to catch the breeze coming over the top of the hill. His eyes went back to the changed child as if pulled there. She seemed even more attractive awake, with sense in those slit-pupiled eyes and life in the supple muscles. He was only too aware of how fascinating she was. Her very differences from humankind were somehow more alluring than if she'd been wholly human. She nodded a greeting to him, then shifted her position a little, so that she could watch him and the griffins at the same time. He noticed that she moved stiffly, as if more than her muscles were hurt.
"So, your charge is awake,"
Trayvan said genially.
"We have been having interesting conversation. Nyara, this is Dark Wind."
She fixed him with an odd, unblinking gaze.
"I remember you. You saved me," she said finally in a low, husky voice that had many of the qualities of a purr. "From the mist. You helped me get out when I fell."
"After you saved the Dyheli herd," he pointed out. "It seemed appropriate, though I could not imagine why you aided them."
He lifted an eyebrow.
"I assume you had a reason."
"I was fleeing my own troubles when I saw them."
She shrugged gracefully. "I am what I am," she replied. "A changed child, and not welcome among the birdkin. When I saw the Dyheli trap, it came to me that it would be good to free them, and also that your folk value them. If I freed them, perhaps the door might be open for one such as I. And also," she added, looking thoughtful, "I have no love for he who trapped them."
"And who might that be?" Darkwind asked, without inflection. He could see what Trayvan had set up, even without a mind-spoken prompting. Since the girl was not afraid of the griffins, their planned positions would be reversed. They would be friendly, and he would be menacing.
A little harder to pull off, with her lounging on the ground like an adolescent male dream come to languid life, but certainly a good plan. It seemed that she was perfectly willing to believe that he would be hostile to her, even with her sexual allure turned up to full force.
"My master," she said, pouting a little at his coldness, "Morna Litha Falkensbane." "Not a friendly name," Hydona said with a little growl.
"Not a friendly man," replied Nyara, with a toss of her head and a wince. "Not a man at all anymore, for all that he is male, or at least very little human. He has worked more changes upon his own flesh than he has upon mine."
"An adept, then," Trayvan said with cheerful interest,
"and one you did not care for, I take it? From your hurts, I would say he was even less kind than he was friendly."
Nyara nodded. Her supple lips tightened into a bitter line.
"Oh, yes, I was the creature upon which he attempted his changes, and if they proved to his liking, he used them also. And he made his mistakes upon me, and often did not bother to correct them. Other things he did, too. Beatings and—"
Her eyes filled with tears, and she averted her head.
He hurt me once too often. That is all I would say."
"So, you ran away from him, is that it?"
Darkwind interrupted the attempt to play for sympathy rudely.
"How did you get away from someone as powerful as that?
I don't imagine he let you simply walk away. And when you saw the Diheli, then what did you do?
She blinked away the tears and rubbed her cheeks with the back of her hand, without raising her head. I have stolen little bits of magic learning from time to time. I have a small power, you see. When Mona Lisa was careless, I watched. I learned. I learned enough to bend the spells of Locke and Ward and slip free of his hold. Then I went north, where I have heard from Mona Lisa's servants that there were birdkin that he hated. She watched him out of the corner of her eye. Do you think less of me, that I thought to use you? You are many. I am one. You have been the cause of some of my hurts, when he was angered with you and could not reach you. I thought, with Birdkin between me and him, he would ignore my flight and harry the Birdkin. He might even think I was with the Birdkin and turn his anger on them. Then I saw the Horned Ones and felt his magic upon them and thought to buy myself sanctuary, or at least safe passage, with their freedom. Her head came up, and she looked defiantly into his eyes. You owe me safe passage at least, Birdkin. Even though I thought to trick Mona Lisa and set him on you, you have defeated him many times. I am but a small thing, and could not even defy him, and escaped him only with guile. He looked sideways at Trevan, who nodded ever so slightly. Everything she'd said was the truth, then. It was probably safe enough to give her what she asked for. We do owe you that, and a place to rest, until you can journey again, he admitted, softening his icy expression a little. He caught the glint of scales out of the corner of his eye, and mind spoke Neera, watching her closely to see if she detected the thoughts. Neera, this change child seems friendly, and she's going to need your help. Shelter for a week or two at least, maybe more. Have you got any tunnels no one is using? The Hirtasi forgot whatever it was that had brought him, now that Darkwind had invoked his authority again. Yes. The old one at the waterline that belonged to Relan and Lorne, that flooded this spring. Again? They finally listened to me and moved out. Unless we have 3 or 4 weeks of rain, it should stay dry. And it was right on the edge of the bluff, with a swamp on one side, a hillside too steep for someone in her condition to climb above, and all the Hirtasi between herself and freedom. That should do. Perfect, he said. And Nayara showed no signs of having heard the conversation. We will make it ready, Neera told him, full of self-importance and content now that he was a major part of whatever was going on. The creature can walk, but slowly. My healer says that there are half-healed bones and torn muscles. Send her in a few moments, and there will be a bed and food waiting. We can give you a place to stay for as long as you need it, he told her, and I will see about getting you safe passage once you're fit to journey again. I don't think you can hope for sanctuary. The elders of this clan hate change children too much. But you do not. She replied, her voice a caress. I don't hate anyone, he said, flushing and averting his eyes, much to Trevan's open amusement. But I don't determine what the elders will say or do. At any rate, Neera and the others are moving some basic things in now, and as soon as you are ready, one of them will come show you where it is. I am grateful, Darkwind, she said, bowing her head a little and looking up at him from under long, thick lashes. I am very grateful. He felt his blood heating from that half-veiled glance, and wondered if she knew what she was promising him with it. Then he decided that she must know. Sex was as much a part of her weaponry as her claws. Don't worry about being grateful, he said gruffly, while Trevan hid his amusement. Just get yourself healed up so we can get you out of this Mona Lisa's reach. The sooner you're gone, the safer we'll all be. They removed themselves to a place farther along the bluff, well out of earshot of the Hirtasi village, before any of them said anything. It was a golden afternoon, near enough to nightfall for things to have cooled down.
sunlight as thick and sweet as honey pouring over the gold-dusted grass of the bluff, with just enough breeze to keep it from being too warm. The griffins fanned their wings out to either side of themselves, basking, their eyes half-lidded and beaks slightly parted. Trayvan's crest was raised as high as it could go, and his chest feathers were puffed out. They looked extraordinarily stupid. Darkwind had to fight off gales of laughter every time he looked at them. Vree, on his good behavior, now that both Darkwind and Trayvan were ready for his tricks, joined them on the grass. He had just taken a bath and looked even sillier than the griffins. Even though he was behaving, he kept eyeing the quills of Trayvan's crest with undisguised longing.
"Will the little ones be all right with you gone so long?" Darkwind asked with concern.
Idona nodded, slowly and lazily.
"The ruins are safe, temporarily. We caught the Weirsa. They were wild, masterless."
"What about that serpent you thought moved into the ruins this spring?" he asked. "The one I found the sign of. It's certainly large enough to make a meal of one of you, let alone Lytha or Jervin."
"It made the mistake of basking on the same stone always," Trayvan replied, his voice full of satisfaction. "It was delicious." "The little ones will be fine," Idona assured him. "Their mind speech is quite strong now, and if they are threatened, they will call. We can be there very quickly."
Having seen the griffins flying at full speed once, he could believe that. They were even faster than Vree, and that was saying something, for Vree was faster than any wild bird he had ever seen.
"So, was she lying about anything?" Darkwind asked, as he pulled the hair away from the back of his neck to let the sun bake into his neck and shoulder muscles.
"Nyara, I mean."
"No," Idona said. "Or mostly no."
"Mostly?" Darkwind said sharply. "Just how much was she lying about?"
"The one she claimed was her master,"
Trayvan said slowly.
"Monolitha Falconsbane," Darkwind supplied. "Sounds to me as if he really does hate Taladras, if he's taken a use name like that." Most adepts assumed use names. The Taladras did it simply to have a name that was more descriptive of what they were, but the Bloodpath adepts did so out of fear. Names were power, though not in the sense that the foolish thought, that knowing someone's true name would permit you to command him. No. By knowing the real name, the birth name, of someone, you could discover everything there was to know about him, if you were thorough and patient enough. You could even see every moment of his past life, if you knew the spell to see into the past. And by knowing that about him, you knew his strengths and weaknesses. And most importantly, you could learn the fears that were the strongest because they were rooted in childhood. It was characteristic of Bloodpath adepts that they had many, many weaknesses, for they generally had never faced what they were and conquered those old fears. There had been cases of mere journeymen besting adepts, sometimes even by illusions, simply by knowing what those fears were and playing to them. But Bloodpath mage or any other kind, the use name told the world something about what the mage was now. A name like Monolitha Falconsbane did not call up easy feelings within a Taladras.
"I do not like that name, Darkwind," Idona said uneasily. "It does not sit well in my mind."
"Nor mine either," Darkwind admitted. "I don't imagine he cares much for anything with wings and feathers."
"Monolitha. Now that's old Taladras. It's actually Kaledain, the language we and the Shinnain had when we were the same people."
"Yes," Trayvan said, interrupting him. "We speak Kaledain fluently."
"You do?" he replied, surprised again.
"That's something to go into with them later, in detail. Where on earth did they ever learn Kaledain? I thought it was a dead language."
"Well, I knew what it was, but what's it mean?"
hatred that returns,
Trevan said solemnly.
A name that speaks of return over the ages, not once, but many times. It is not rebirth. It is actual return, and return looking for revenge. It is an evil word, Dark Wind, as evil as you find Falkenspain to be.
The words hung heavy and ill-omened between them, silencing all three of them for a moment and bringing a chill to the air.
Typical bloodpath intimidation, Darkwind said in disgust,
attempting to make light of it and dispel the gloom.
Trying to frighten people with a portentous name and a fancy costume. Frankly, I'd like to know where they're finding people willing to make clothing like that. Those ridiculous cloaks and headdresses. They look as if they were designed by an apprentice to traveling players with delusions of grandeur. Half the time, they can't even walk or see properly in those outfits.
Trevan laughed.
Oh, and who is it has an entire collection of Raven Wings feather masks on his walls?
That's different, he replied, defending himself. That's art. Back to the subject. What was it Nyara lied about in connection with her master? Wasn't he her master, after all?
Oh, he was her master, yes, but he was more. Something more. Intimate.
Trevan shook his head and looked over at his mate, who nodded. Yes, said Hydona, but not intimate, as in lovers. There is no love there. It was something else. Darkwind tried to puzzle that one out, then gave it up.
I'll think about that for a while. Maybe the connection will come to me.
She did escape, though, right?
Oh, yes. Hydona replied emphatically. Yes, she did escape and was pursued. I would say that her story is true, all of it that she told us, that is.
I wish I'd been able to ask her more questions, he said, chewing at his lower lip as he thought. I wish I'd been able to think of more questions.
It seems clear enough,
Trevan said lazily, stretching his forelegs out into the sun a little more.
She is exactly what she seems.
A changed child, used to try out the changes her master wanted to perform on his own body.
Used as a sex toy when he wished.
Yes, Hydona nodded, and used also to raise and hold power for him. You did not see that upon her? He looked up at the sky in exasperation.
Of course! I missed that aspect completely. I could not imagine why Falkenbane would allow her to keep her mage gift intact when an adept should be able to block it or render it useless by burning the channels. But if she didn't have enough to challenge him, but did have enough to carry power, she would make the perfect vessel,
Trevan concluded. Exactly. Hydona replied. He could use her to carry power from his sacrifices. He could generate power from her by hurting her. And best of all, Darkwind concluded grimly, he could exhaust her power without touching his own. That made it possible for him to work spells that don't disturb the energy flows around here at all, because it's all internal power. That is how he's been doing things without my sensing them.
Sensing them?
Trevan opened one eye.
I thought you had given up your mage's skills.
I have, he replied firmly, but I can still sense the power flows and the disturbances when someone tampers with them. As long as I'm not inside the veil, that is.
That heartstone is a problem, Darkwind.
Trevan said unexpectedly.
It is distorting everything in the area of the veil, as if it were a thick warped pane of glass. And when things come into this area, like the serpent, it is attracting them. I am surprised that no one in there has noticed the problems.
Darquin shook his head, compressing his lips tightly. If I say what I'd like to. Well, that's Vale business, and the Elder's business, and you
are outsiders,
Treyvan replied, rolling his eye in exasperation.
And if your father discovered you had been speaking of Vale business to outsiders, what then would he cast you out? It might be worth it, Darkwind. This is involving more than just Kashena. The broken heartstone begins to affect the area outside the Vale.
No. He shook his head emphatically. I have a duty to my clan, and to what the Taladrath are supposed to be. I guess. He thought for a moment.
I suppose I'm just waiting for the moment that they all bury themselves, and I can find out where Kavala or Katreva are now, and I can go get some help.
May that be soon, Hydona sighed.
Too true.
He eyed the sun and stood up, then hesitated a moment. You know my personal reasons for giving up magic, and, well, I wouldn't admit it to anyone but you, but I'm beginning to think that may have been, well, a little short-sighted. Treyvan tilted his head.
I will not say that I told you the same.
I know you did. But now, he frowned, if the Heartstone is attracting uncanny things, it is probably a good idea not to rescind that vow. Look what happened to the one mage who tried casting spells outside the Vale.
A good point,
Treyvan acknowledged. But you still show adept potential, do you not? Would that not attract creatures as well as spell casting? He tilted his head the other way. A distinct liability to a scout, I would say. He flushed.
Treyvan, I'm not stupid.
I thought of that. I swore I wouldn't spellcast.
I never swore I wouldn't keep my shields.
Treyvan laughed aloud.
Good. You are as canny as I could wish, flightless son.
He had to laugh himself. Well, Nera has things well in hand for now. You have youngsters to get back to. And I guess I'd better finish out my patrol, tell Dawnfire the good news if she doesn't know already, and figure out how best to phrase Nyara's request to the elders. Treyvan chuckled.
She won't be moving far or fast for a few days, if I'm any judge of human shapes. You'll have some time to think.
Tharquin sighed.
I hope so, he replied. It isn't going to be easy. Starblade is not going to like this.
Chapter 11. Elspeth.
Skiff peered through the foggy gloom of near dawn, wishing he had eyes like a cat. He watched for possible trouble, as Elspeth stood, literally, on her saddle, trying to read the signpost in the middle of the crossroads. Gwyneth stood like a stone statue, a distinct improvement over a horse in a similar situation. Before they had left Bolthaven, Elspeth had taken Quentin's advice quite literally, and very much to heart. For one thing, she'd consulted with him about disguises, in lieu of being able to ask Carolyn. Now they wore something more in the line of what a pair of prosperous mercenaries would wear.
Mercs would be best, Quentin had decided after a long discussion, and taking into consideration the fact that no amount of dye would stain the companions' coats. Tell people who ask you've been bodyguards for a rich merchant's daughter, and that's where you got the matched horses. If you say you're mercs, no one will bother you, and you can wear your armor and weapons openly. Just put a coat of paint on those shields, or get a cover for them. They'd given him carte blanche and a heavy pouch of coin.
He'd grinned when Skiff lifted an eyebrow over the selection of silks and fine leathers Quentin's agent brought back from the Bolthaven market, clothing that was loose and comfortable, and so did not need to be tailored to them to look elegant.
We want you two to look prosperous, he'd said. First of all, only a prosperous merc would be able to afford horses like yours, even if you did get them in the line of duty. And secondly,
A prosperous merc is a good fighter. No bandit is ever going to want to bother a mercenary who looks as well off as you will. The last place a merc puts his money is in his wardrobe. If you can afford this, you're not worrying about needing cash for other things.
But the jewelry, Skiff had protested. You've turned most of our ready cash into jewelry.
A freelance merc wears his fortune, Quentin told him. If you need to buy something and you don't want to spend any of those Outland gold coins because it might draw attention to you, break off a couple of links of those necklaces, take a plate from the belt, hand over a ring or a bracelet. That's the way a merc operates, and no one is going to turn a hair. Very few mercs bother with keeping money with a money-changing house because it won't be readily accessible. In fact, only about half of even bonded mercs have a running account with a mercenary's guild, for the same reason. Where you're going, every merchant and most good inns have scales to weigh the gold and silver, and they'll give you a fair exchange for it.
Skiff thought about what he said, then sent Quentin's agent back to the bazaar to exchange the rest of their Valdemarin and Rethwellen gold and silver for jewelry. He had to admit that the ornaments he got in exchange, a mixture of brand new and worn with use, were a great deal less traceable than the Valdemarin coin. He felt like a walking target, his old thief instincts acting up again, but he knew very well that when he was a thief, he'd never ever have tackled two wealthy fighters, especially when they walked with their hands on their hilts and never drank more than one flagon of wine at a sitting. Quentin had been right. A wealthy, cautious fighter was someone that tended not to attract trouble. Still, he'd complained to Elspeth their first night on the road that he felt like a cheap tavern dancer, with his necklaces making more noise than his chainmail. Elspeth had giggled, saying she felt like a North Province bride, with all her dowry around her neck, but she had no objections to following Quentin's advice. He still resented that, a little. He'd made a similar suggestion, though he had suggested they dress as a pair of landed hill folk rather than mercs, and she had dismissed the notion out of hand. But when Quentin told them to disguise themselves, she had agreed immediately. Maybe it was simply that he suggested plain, unglamorous hill folk, and Quentin had suggested the opposite. Skiff had the feeling she was beginning to enjoy this. She was picking up the kind of swaggering walk the other well-off mercs they met had adopted, and she had taken to binding up her hair with bright bands of silk and some of the strands of garnet and amethyst beads Quentin had bought. There were eye-catching silk scarves trailing from the hilt of Need and binding the helm at her saddle bow. She looked like a barbarian, and he got the distinct impression she liked looking that way. Her eyes sparkled the moment they crossed into a town and found a tavern, and she began grinning when other mercs sought them out to exchange stories and news. One night she'd even taken up with another prosperous female freelance, Selina Ironthroat, and had made the rounds of every tavern in town. The gods only know what they did. I don't even want to think about it. At least she came back sober, even if she was giggling like a maniac. If half the stories those other mercs told me about Selina are true, her mother would never forgive me. Not only that, she took the inevitable attempts at assignations with a cheerful good humor that amazed him. He'd expected her to explode with anger the first time it happened. She had been the center of a gossiping clutch of guild mercs, but as the evening wore on, one by one they drifted off, leaving her alone for a moment. That was when a merc, with almost as much gold around his neck as she wore, had tried to get her to go off with him, and presumably into his bed. He readied himself for a brawl. Then she'd shocked the blazes out of him. She'd laughed, but not in a way that would make the man feel she was laughing at him, and said, in a good approximation of Rethwellen Hill Country dialect, "Oh, now that is a truly tempting offer. 'Tis in very deed, but I misdoubt ye want to make me partner there feel I've left him alone." She nodded at Skiff, who simply gave the merc the look. "Don't mess with my partner," and turned back to his beer, with one cautious eye on the proceedings. "He gets right testy when he thinks he's going to be alone. Truly he does," she continued, a friendly grin on her face, her eyes shining as she got into her part. "Ye see, his last partner left him all by himself one night,
and some sorry son of a sow snuck up on him when he wasn't paying attention and hit him with a bottle.
Her face went thoughtful for a moment.
'Twas sad, that. He not only took it out on his partner, God's grant the pure man heals up quick, he took it out on the lads as took the pure fellow off. He hates having no one to watch his back. He truly do.
The other merc looked at Skip, who glowered back, gulped, and allowed as how he, too, hated having no one to guard his back.
"Then let's buy you a drink, lad," she'd exclaimed, slapping him so hard on the back that he'd staggered. "When times be prosperous, 'tis only right to share 'em. No hard feelings among mercs, huh? Now, where are ye bound for?"
Oh, yes, indeed. She looked and acted the part. A far cry from the competent but quiet princess of Valdemar, who never had seen the inside of a common tavern in her life. As he waited for her to decipher the sign, he wondered, as he had wondered several times before this, if she wasn't enjoying it a bit too much. She dropped down into her saddle by the simple expedient of doing just that, her feet slipping down along the sides as she fell straight down, and he winced. That was one of Caro's favorite tricks, and it always made men wince. "We're on the right road if we go straight ahead," she said. "That's Dark Wing Road, and we don't want it. It's going into the Pelagirus Forest in a couple of leagues, and it doesn't come out until it hits the edge of the Derisha Plains. No towns, no inns, no nothing. We want this one. It's still the Pelagirus Road, and in a while it'll meet the High Spur Road. And that takes us to Lifecare." On the map, this Darkwing Road had looked to be a very minor track, but it was just as well maintained in reality as the High Spur Road they expected to take. Of course, now that she'd pointed out what it was obvious that it went in the wrong direction. But with all this dark mist confusing his senses, "I'm all turned around in this fog," he complained. "That's what you get for being a city boy," she replied, ridiculously cheerful for such an unholy hour. "Get you off of the street, and you can't find your way around." She sent Gwena to join him, then took the lead. His companion followed after with no prompting on his part, the fog muffling the sounds of hooves and the jingle of harness. His nose was cold, and the fog had an odd metallic taste and smell to it. He hated getting up this early at the best of times. The fog made it that much worse.
"You're just as much city bred as me," he countered resentfully, a harder edge to his voice than he had intended. "Since when did you get to be such an expert on wilderness travel?"
She swiveled quickly and peered back at him, hardly more than a dark shape in the enshrouding fog. "What's wrong with you?" she asked, astonishment and a certain amount of edge in her voice as well.
"Nothing," he said quickly. Then, with more truth, "Well, not much. I hate mornings. I hate fog. And there's something that's been bothering me."
"You're different. It's as if you're turning into Caro."
"Or even Selena Ironthroat."
"So what if I am?" she countered. "What would you rather have next to you in trouble? Caro, or a mousy little Princess Elspeth who would have let you try and figure out where we were going and what we were doing? What's wrong with turning into Caro? That's assuming that I am. I happen to think you're wrong about that." Now it was his turn to be surprised. He'd never heard her refer to herself as a mousy little princess before. And while she had sometimes railed about things to him, she'd never turned on him before. He replied, cleverly.
"Or is it just that I won't let you take care of me? Is that the problem?"
He heard the annoyance in her voice that meant she was scowling.
"You've been sulking since we left Bolthaven, and I'm getting damn tired of it. As long as I let you make all the decisions, everything was fine. But this is my trip, and I'm the one with the authority, and you know it. I pull my own weight, Skiff. I was perfectly capable of doing this trip by myself. In fact, I was ready to. I admit I didn't think about disguises, and you were right about that idea. But the fact is, if I'd been able to go on my own, I was intending to travel by night and hide by day. And if anyone saw me, I was going to pretend I was a ghost rider and scare the blazes out of him."
"It's not that you're making the decisions. It's just the changes in you. You're so hearty," he said feebly.
You're kind of loud, actually. Everybody notices us wherever we go. I thought the point was to keep from drawing attention to ourselves. She snorted, and it wasn't ladylike. You think these costumes aren't going to draw attention to us? Come on, Skiff. We're walking advertisements for the life of the Merc. Sure I'm loud. That's what a woman like Berta would be. Like Selena Ironthroat. I spent that night studying her, I'll have you know. I'm competing for men's money in a man's world, and I'm doing damn well at it, and the more I advertise that fact, the more jobs I'll be offered. In fact, I've been offered jobs, quite a few of them. I turned them down, saying we were going off to take another job with a caravan we were picking up at Katashinain.
Oh, he replied, feeling overwhelmed.
Admittedly, he hadn't thought much about the part he was supposedly playing. Certainly not the way she had. She had everything, motives, background, character, even an imaginary job that would give them an excuse to turn down any other offers. Don't cosset me, Skiff, she said, her voice roughened with anger. I'm sick to death of being cosseted. Kara wouldn't, and you know it. This is exactly the kind of job she'd love. She'd be right beside me, slapping those drunks on the back. And if she had to, I bet she'd be hauling them off to bed with her, too.
Elspeth!
He yelped before he thought. There, she said triumphantly. You see? What's the matter? Don't you think I know about the simple facts of a man and a woman? An ordinary man and woman, not heralds, the kind of people who are driven by the needs of the moment? Just what exactly are you trying to protect me from? The idea that drunk strangers grab each other and hop into strange beds and proceed to form... He tried, but he couldn't help himself. He emitted an inarticulate moan. Each other's tails off, she finished, right over the top of him. And I deliberately didn't use any of the 10 or so rude words I know for the act, just to avoid bruising your delicate sensibilities. I can swear with the worst of the Mercs if I have to, and I know hundreds of filthy jokes, and furthermore, I know exactly what they mean. I've spent lots of time with Caro's Skybolts, and they treated me just like one of them. Skiff, I grew up. I'm not the little sister that you used to leave candy for. And I don't need you to shelter me from what I already know. A pause, during which he tried to think of something to say. Stop treating me like a child, Skiff. I'm not a little girl anymore. I haven't been for a long time. And that's the problem, he thought unhappily. She wasn't a little girl anymore, and he wasn't sure how to act around her. It wasn't that competence in women bothered him. He loved Talia dearly, and he looked up to Caro as to his very own captain, for she was one of the few at court to whom his background meant nothing in particular. It was seeing that confidence in Elspeth that bothered him. He couldn't help but think that it wasn't confidence. It was a foolish overconfidence, the headiness of freedom. The warnings Quentin had given him had made him wary to the point of paranoia. Every time someone approached her, he kept examining them for some sign that they weren't what they seemed, that they were really bloodpath mages stalking her, like a cat stalking a baby rabbit. She just doesn't understand, he confided to his companion, thinking that she, at least, would sympathize. There are all those mages out there, Quentin warned us about. She doesn't even think about them. She doesn't watch for them, and she's not trying to hide from them. But you warned her about everything Quentin said, Kimry said, answering his thought. You told her everything you knew. She may be right about hiding in plain sight, you know. Why would a mage look for someone like her to have mage gifts? Everyone knows mages can't be fighters. Besides, don't you think she's as capable as you are of telling if someone is stalking her? Yes, but in fact, she continued thoughtfully, it's entirely possible that she would know sooner than you. She does have mage abilities, even if they aren't trained. Quentin said that power calls to power, and she's keeping a watch on the thoughts of everyone around her. Don't you think she'd know another mage if one came back close to her? Yes. But, he lapsed into silence, because that wasn't all, or even most of what was bothering him.
She'd grown up, all right. She was no longer anything he could think of as a girl, and whether it was the new attitude, or the new clothing, or both, he couldn't help noticing just how much she had grown up. Certainly the new clothing, far more flamboyant than anything she wore at home, enhanced that perception. It seemed almost as if she had taken on a new life with the new persona. Maybe it was also, at least in part, the fact that no one was watching them together. There was no one to start rumors, no one to warn him that she was not exactly an appropriate partner for an ex-thief, no one to wink and nod whenever he walked by with her, no one to ask, with arch significance, how she was doing lately. The friends had been as annoying as the opponents. But now both were gone, far out of distance of any gossip, and he was free to look at her as Elspeth instead of the heir to the throne. And he was discovering how much he liked what he saw. She was handsome in the same vibrant way Carol was. And admits, he thought to himself, you're more than half in love with Carol. Clever, witty, with a ready laugh that more than made up for her whiplash temper. Oh, she was a handful. But a handful he wouldn't mind having by his side. Dear God! A sudden realization made him blush so hotly he was very glad that the fog was still thick enough to hide it. It wasn't outraged sensibilities that made him yelp at the idea of her entertaining one of those mercs in bed. It was jealousy, the very last emotion he'd ever have anticipated entertaining, especially over Elspeth. He didn't want her running off with someone else. He wanted her to run off with him. He must have been giving an ample demonstration of his jealousy over the past few days. Surely she had guessed long before he had. But now that he thought about it, she didn't seem to notice anything except his increasing protectiveness. Mother Henning, she called it. This wasn't the first time she'd complained about it, but it was the first time she had done so at the top of her lungs. She might not have noticed his attraction, but she had certainly noticed the side effects. I guess she's really mad, he thought guiltily, and cleared his throat, hoping to restart the conversation and get it turned back onto friendlier ground. She didn't say anything, but she didn't turn around and snap at him either. The growing light of dawn filtered through the fog, enveloping them both in a glowing, pearly haze, and it was a good thing they were both wearing their barbaric merc outfits. The companions just faded into the general glow, and if they'd been wearing whites, they'd have lost each other in a heartbeat. This kind of mist fuddled directions and the apparent location of sound, too. He peered at her fog-enshrouded shape up ahead of him. It looked uncannily as if she was bestriding a wisp of fog itself. End of Side 5.